We thank you, O God, for bringing Christ to life again, for birthing new life in each of our hearts. We pray that you would be present now in these words that are spoken and in our ears and in our minds and in our hearts as we receive them. Amen. At Jesus' birth, the wise men came with gifts for the infant. And at his death, the women came to tend and care for his body. It was the custom in Palestine in Jesus' day to visit the tomb of a loved one for 3 days following their death and burial. It was believed that the person's spirit lingered around the grave for these days following death. Jesus died on a Friday. His friends couldn't come the following Saturday, it being the Sabbath and against the law. And those who appeared early at the tomb that Sunday morning likely had not had much sleep the night before, as those of us in grief often find sleep elusive. So Mary Magdalene came early, first thing that third morning on Sunday. And she arrived and she found the enormous stone covering the grave rolled away. And she was bewildered. Had someone come and desecrated the tomb? Had someone come to rob this grave? It was too much for her to bear on her own. So she ran and found other disciples and she told them what she had seen. And it says that Peter and the disciple that Jesus loved came with her. And they set out for the grave at a run. And John outpaces Peter and runs on in. And then he runs back out. But Peter goes in more deeply. And he finds Jesus's body isn't there. Merely the grave clothes folded where his body had lain. The men rush off again. But Mary stays. She lingers. And she stays there just weeping. Not sure where to go or what to do. Perhaps she was grieving what might have been. We know that unfinished business lingers in every graveyard. Broken promises, lives cut short, countless secrets buried with the departed. Sometimes we go there to speak to our loved ones. To explain or apologize or plead or just to feel close to some piece of them. But silence holds firm. It says in verse 11 that Mary stood outside of the tomb crying and she bent and looked in. You know, grief never asks permission. And grief doesn't play out for any two of us in the same way. It affects us in ways that often we wouldn't anticipate. You know, it'd be great if we could fall apart on our own schedule. But usually it happens when something triggers you, in the line at the grocery store, when you catch a glimpse of a face that reminds you of someone, or a whiff of perfume, or you hear a melody, something that brings them back, and suddenly you fall apart with no warning. No way to try to make nice. I don't know anyone but pageant queens who still look fabulous when they start to weep. And I think that has to do with a lot of foundation. For most of us, grief is messy. It's uncontrollable. It's as though you step into this parallel but alternate plane for some time. Parts of us die and go with the ones that we love. After Jesus' death, the disciples all react in different ways. Some of them hide out, afraid to leave their homes, and others look for ways to stay busy and immediately start going back to their old work again. Some run, some weep. You know, often when we encounter something that just threatens to really knock us back on our heels, often our tendency is just to fight to stay standing no matter what, to try to shove that grief down, to try to tough it out. We think that somehow this is a victory, that it's grieving well. But I would ask us to question that assumption. Maybe learning to give in and fall apart is part of grieving well. Because falling apart can be its own kind of grace and beauty. Because when we crumble, we're able to suddenly look at all the pieces and preserve the remnant that's still there, but present in an entirely new way. Many of you participated in the Read Across Rhode Island book by Brian Stevenson this past month. Many people were reading his book, Just Mercy. And for those of you who haven't, I would encourage you to take a read, open this book. And Brian Stevenson is a civil rights lawyer. He is a leader of the Equal Justice Initiative and has been working for decades to defend people without lawyers who are on death row, particularly in the South. And he wrote in his book about a time when he was at a particularly low point in his work. He was worn down from the strains of his calling, from the stories and the circumstances of his clients, and his inability to stretch his person any further. He was at a breaking point. He was past the breaking point. He was broken. He writes that the lack of compassion that he witnessed every day finally just exhausted him. And he looked around at his crowded office, at the stacks of papers cataloging people's tragic stories. And suddenly he said he didn't want to be surrounded by all this anguish and misery anymore. He sat there and he thought he was a fool for even trying to fix any of these circumstances in the first place. He told himself that it was okay, that he could stop now. He just couldn't do it anymore. He says for the first time he looked around and saw that every aspect of his life, everything that surrounded him, was broken. He worked in a broken system of justice. His clients were broken by mental illness and poverty and racism. They were torn apart by disease and drugs and pride and fear and anger. He saw people who were broken by poverty and war and disability. And in their brokenness, they were judged and condemned by people whose commitment to fairness had been broken by their own cynicism and hopelessness and prejudice. But then he writes that something happened. In that moment of looking at everything that was shattered around him, something shifted. He said he understood that he didn't do what he did because he was required to, or because it was necessary, or not even because it was important or that he had no choice. He said he realized that he engaged in this work because he was broken too. All his years of struggling against inequality and abuse of power and poverty, oppression and injustice finally revealed something to him about himself. Being that close to all that suffering, to death and executions and cruel punishment, didn't just illuminate the brokenness of others. In that moment of heartbreak, it also exposed his own shattered nature. And he recognized that you can't continue to fight abuse of power and inequality and oppression without being broken by it. Friends, all of us are broken by something. We've all hurt someone. We've all been hurt. And we share this condition of brokenness, even if the ways we break isn't the same. We know that in our brokenness, we relate to one another. The ways that I have been hurt and have hurt others aren't the same ways that you have been hurt and hurt others. But our shared brokenness connects us. Thomas Merton once said that we are bodies of broken bones. And in many ways, it's this brokenness that makes us human. Jesus understood this, and in his full humanity lived this all the way to the cross. God knew that in order for us to fully relate to Jesus, he would have to be as broken as any one of us. Brian Stevenson observes that sometimes We become fractured by the choices that we make. Sometimes we're shattered by things that we cannot control and would never have chosen. But this becomes the basis of our common humanity, our shared search for comfort and meaning and healing. Our imperfection makes us compassionate. Frederick Buechner once said that it would help us all if we would be willing to keep track of the times and the events in our lives that bring tears to our eyes. They may be happy or sad moments. It may be a funeral or a wedding, a patriotic event, a particular song. It could be at any unexpected time or place. But whenever you are stirred to such depths, these are the times that God is at work in your life. These emotional hot spots in our lives, when something breaks through the veneer of hardness that we tend to entomb ourselves in, that we ought to pay most attention to. These are, in many ways, windows that the light of God is able to shine through us and into us. So often we just want to slam these doors shut. We don't want to experience our own pain, and we certainly don't want to let anybody else seeing us fall apart or be vulnerable. But when we slam those doors and windows shut, we in many ways cut off God's access to us. So check the times and the places when you weep, and you will see the places that God is able to get through to you. There was a country preacher who was going and visiting shut-ins, and one of them said, "Preacher, how was the service this past Sunday?" And he said, "It was wonderful. Everybody cried." Pay attention to your tears and don't be afraid to weep and to linger in these places. It gives us an insight into what matters most deeply to us and helps us understand what we believe and often why. Because you know that grief is something we can't control, just as we can't control the workings of the Spirit. You can't rush it. You can't tame it. You just have to let it wash over you. You have to endure it and walk through it until one day you recognize that it's starting to ease up bit by bit. What used to be an open wound is now just sore. And maybe eventually it becomes a scar. It's always there. But the pain isn't quite as acute. In the text we heard this morning, Mary is the first to discover the open tomb and Jesus' missing body. And she runs to tell the others who come to see for themselves. But Mary stays. She remains at the site of her grief and she cries. And strangers come and meet her there in her grief. And she has to repeat her story and name her grief over and over again. But she has a revelation when she is forced to continue to name her pain, to tell and retell her story. It begins to take a new form. Each of us has a choice when the world breaks our heart. It can make us more brittle, more fragile, or we can break open and embrace our humanity, replete with these broken places. This means allowing for grief and letting others weep with us, showing our vulnerability to others. Because when we do this, we expand our capacity for compassion and empathy. And this compassion remains our best hope for healing. My friend's father, Bob Rosenblum, died of cancer last year. On March 21st, he would have been 70. And on that day, his daughter, Susie Rosenblum Schwartz, and her children decided to go on a campaign of kindness. Armed with a piece of paper with a photograph of their father, which said, "Please accept this random act of kindness in memory of Bob Rosenblum. Today would have been Bob's 70th birthday. He was always a giving person and he loved life. So please smile and pay it forward." Susie said it was an amazing day filled with random acts of kindness in memory of her dad on his birthday. She started off buying Starbucks for a handful of cars as they went through the drive-through line. And then she brought Snickers and flowers to Doris, the bank teller that her father went to for 20 years. And then lunch at the supply company where he worked for 36 years. After that, she picked her kids up from school and they just kept going. They taped microwave popcorn to Redbox locations around Buffalo Grove. They passed out flowers outside of Walgreens to everyone who was leaving. And they bought a family dinner at Red Robin to finish off their day. She said, "We made a lot of people smile that day. And they even made a few people cry." She said, "Kindness always wins. Always." Tears can be healing. Resurrection can come through our grief. We can come to know the shape of our losses and ourselves and God all over again. Mary's turning point comes when she continues to walk through her grief, being willing to be present to her own pain and to name that to others, even to this gardener who comes and asks her, "Why are you weeping?" In the garden, Jesus wasn't recognized. And in the upper room later, Jesus was completely unknown. Grief can blind us to what we once knew. But we have to allow ourselves to break open and see what's right in front of us. You know, some would choose to ignore their own hurts in favor of numbness and denial, forswearing compassion towards themselves or anyone else. Brian Stevenson reflects that his clients, the people on death row, the people, he said he often thought of the people who would cheer their deaths, who would consider it a victory. And he realized that those people were also broken, whether or not they were able or willing to admit it. Stevenson reflects on the victims of violent crime and how many of us feel like if we can just get tough with ourselves and tough with others, it'll make it seem like we're able to stand against all these things that hurt us. But when we are willing to allow ourselves to feel this pain instead of insisting that it be recycled back on someone else, we're able to experience a different kind of transformation. Instead of simply punishing those who are broken by walking away from them or hiding them from sight, which would only ensure that they and we remain broken, we need to learn as Mary did, and as Susie and her family did, and as Brian learned with his clients, that we are more than our brokenness. We're more than just our grief. There's a strength and a power even in admitting our vulnerability and the places where we hurt and are broken. And when we embrace this, we are able to embrace the same mercy that God pours out on each one of us. We began to understand things that we never could have comprehended unless we allowed ourselves to break open in these ways. We began to recognize our common humanity binding us together. I mean, what would happen if we allowed ourselves to experience our grief? That we didn't try to hide our weaknesses and our vulnerabilities, our deficits, our biases, our fears? What if we let them break us open to see and feel in new kinds of ways? And maybe if we did, we wouldn't be so bent on destroying other people who are also broken in our midst. Maybe if we no longer took pride in punishing others who were already wounded, but instead sought to be a source of healing out of the places where we too have been tended to in our brokenness. You know, it's no accident that day that Jesus appeared to Mary as a gardener, someone who coaxes life forth from where it would appear none existed. You know, because seeds certainly look pretty dead, or at least inert. They don't move. Nothing's going on in there. And if from the perspective of metabolic processes, not a lot's going on inside of a seed. And if a seed isn't allowed to germinate, it will, in fact, die. the embryo inside of it. Each species of seed has a different time frame. Some maples have to germinate within a few weeks of being dispersed or they'll die. And some lotus flowers seeds can be germinated even after 2,000 years of being buried as a seed. But in order to grow, to sustain new life, a seed must first break open and reveal what's inside and no longer be a seed. Mary turned and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't recognize him. And then she turns and looks in a new way. That movement from grief to joy. Looking beyond just the sight of her eyes, she hears Jesus call her name, and she recognizes him in this familiar gesture. You know, the word human and humus and humility all come from the same root. And they're not just etymologically related. When Jesus humbled himself and became human, he did so that he might experience these things so that we could understand that we too can walk in the path that he laid forth for us all. John 12 says, I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Wendell Berry says, if healthy soil is full of death, it is also full of life. Worms and fungi and microorganisms of all kinds. Given only the health of the soil, nothing that dies stays dead for very long. God is the original gardener, creating not only Eden, but new lives within each one of us by digging deeply into the dirt of the earth, into the soil of our own souls. And so it is fitting then that Christ was buried in a garden, a seed planted in the ground that blossomed into a flower of transformed humanity. Christ came to Mary as a gardener, for he is the master gardener and we the apprentices as well as the subjects of his labors. Where might we meet Jesus today? Would we recognize him for who he is? David Hammons, a New York artist, originally from Illinois, has been making art since the 60s and 70s. And in the late 80s, he put up a huge billboard in Washington, D.C. of a blonde and blue-eyed Jesse Jackson. Underneath it, it said, "How you like me now?" And it took folks a while to realize who it was because he was familiar, but not quite the way that they remembered him. So often we want to find Jesus, but our expectations of who he is and how he will appear are just too narrow. We think he can only appear in one way or in one place or in one time. But what if we were willing to linger in the places of our pain, to check our assumptions and to be willing to be broken open? The people that knew Jesus closely and intimately couldn't recognize him when he reappeared to them. Because Jesus comes into our lives in ways that we might not expect, quietly, more gently than we might anticipate. Standing like he did with Mary, just over her shoulder, quietly consoling, slipping behind locked doors, offering peace, and breathing out the Spirit of God upon them all. The disciples and others in Jerusalem in those days expected that Jesus would take down the political machine. And their faith had a lot at that time to do with hoping for a time when the good and the faithful would finally overthrow these Roman oppressors. And yet Jesus comes back and shatters their expectations. Isn't this the way of God, not appearing in the ways that we would have orchestrated, but in God's own ways, breaking us open and open again until we're finally able to recognize God in our midst? We too are like these seeds, full of energy and potential, waiting to be freed from our protective shells. The story of the life of a Christian isn't just the story of life after death, but about life coming out of death. Not about life after death, but about life and death and life again. This is about living resurrected lives every day of your living. You know, God weaves resurrection into our daily lives so that we can learn the shape of it and perhaps trust it when it finally comes. Resurrection is transformative, and we don't return in the same ways that we left before. It's dying to our smaller selves and discovering our larger self. It's this transformation that takes place every moment. E.B. White once described his beloved and aging wife, Catherine, as she knelt to plant bulbs in the October wind. He wrote that as the years went by and age overtook her, this small, hunched over figure, her studied absorption in the implausible notion that there would yet be another spring, oblivious to the ending of her own days, which she knew perfectly well were near at hand, sitting there still with her detailed chart under those dark skies in the dying October, calmly plotting resurrection. This Easter morning, friends, may you likewise plot resurrection in your own hearts, in the community around you. What death are you living through that you need to be resurrected from today? What would our world look like if we celebrated this not just on Easter morning, but every day of our living? How might we, like Mary, like Brian Stevenson, like Bob Rosenblum's children, take our grief and our brokenness and call forth from it new life? God brings new life into dead places. So open your eyes and your heart a little bit wider. Yes, we do live in a world of hurt and brokenness. And yes, we live in a world of healing and mercy. The world will break your heart. But don't let it shatter you. Let it break you open to more compassion, more wonder. Wide enough to hold more compassion and love and more life. Amen.